Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. We are continuing our series, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance? We've heard from several people in favor of reviewing or resentencing every juvenile lifer case. Many prosecutors are not in favor of that. Yesterday, we heard criticism from ACLU attorney Deborah LaBelle, who's been trying to get the state to do more with juvenile lifers. Here's a bit of what she said.
The prosecutors in some counties filed for every single youth in their county. There were youths who didn't even commit a homicide that they're now asking the court to say, that's the rare one. That's the irreparable one. That's the uncommon one.
Michigan prosecutors have come under national scrutiny for what critics have argued is an effort to ignore or at least slowly comply with the recent Supreme Court rulings that require all juveniles sentenced to mandatory life without parole to have their sentences reconsidered. We contacted Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette's office about an interview. Schuette has been a national leader in opposing resentencing of juvenile lifers. His office filed a brief with the Supreme Court on behalf of Michigan and 15 other states that opposed allowing those who've already been convicted of life without parole to have their sentences reconsidered. Schuette's office declined our interview request. Instead, his staff referred us to Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton, who joins me now. I want to go back to before the 2012 Supreme Court ruling, which decided mandatory life sentences for those under the age of 18 was cruel and unusual punishment and therefore unconstitutional. What kind of discretion did a prosecutor have in regards to pursuing life sentences for juveniles convicted of someone back then?
Well, we had considerable discretion, and there were many, many cases across the state that did not get charged where juveniles faced life without parole. I'm certain, although I don't have the facts and figures, but I'm certain just from knowing what I've done over the years that in many instances, juveniles are charged as juveniles. We have the choice of charging them as juveniles and leaving them in the juvenile system. We can charge them as adults but leave them in the juvenile system, which allows for a blended sentence, when we can charge them as adults. So we had a lot of latitude that we could use based upon the circumstances. And knowing as many prosecutors as I do, I know that most have exercised that discretion over the years.
I understand that 17-year-olds were automatically charged as adults. Is that correct? And what did you think of that as a mandate?
Well, that's Michigan law. In Michigan, a 17-year-old is considered an adult. It's unlike many of the other states. There is a push on now to change our law to 18, but that, of course, would kick into issue many other situations that really have to be addressed before that law can be changed. So we just followed the law that was imposed by the legislature and the governors of past.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of what those other complications might be?
Well, you would have to, of course, account for 17-year-olds in the juvenile system. You would have to make more funding available for juveniles for rehabilitation purposes. So there's a number of funding type issues that would come into play.
How have things changed for your office for cases like that since 2012, since that ruling, or have you had any cases like that?
Well, we have. We've had a number of cases. I don't have the number right in front of me, but even since Miller and Montgomery, we have had juvenile life without parole cases. What I really want to make certain everybody understands is that these cases are the most egregious cases that you see. Every single juvenile life without parole case is a case of somebody who's been convicted of first degree or felony murder. And so these are not larceny in a building cases. These are not even armed robbery or carjacking cases, which are, very serious, heinous crimes. These are first degree or felony murder cases. Sadly, in Genesee County, we have too many of them, and we have had a first degree murder case with a defendant as young as 13 years of age. And that, of course, is somebody too young to be charged as an adult. But we had a trial in that case. So, I mean, I've seen it all in this county.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court decided, as you mentioned, that Montgomery case, the 2012 ruling should be retroactive. That is, except in exceedingly rare cases, people who were juveniles and sentenced to life in the past would have to be resentenced. What's that meant in Genesee County?
We had 26 such cases, according to the Department of Corrections and according to our own internal review. I mean, among other things, it meant a lot of work for a staff of prosecutors who are already overworked. We have probably the highest per capita caseload for criminal prosecutors in the state. Kim Worthy and I will go back and forth on this issue from time to time, but I think we have a pretty high caseload. So it meant more work for our prosecutors to start with. And then there were logistics issues. Some of these cases are as old as 50 years. We had to find the files, and oftentimes that can be difficult for a file that's not all that old. So we had to find the files. Then we had to review them. We had to order records from the Department of Corrections, which in and of itself was a task. We had to order medical records of the prisoners separately through the Department of Corrections. Once everything was gathered, then each individual prosecutor sat down, looked at their file for which they were responsible. Then I scheduled meetings of all the prosecutors to come and sit with me and my other top assistants and present the cases to us. And then, of course, from that point on, if we had additional information that we needed, we asked for it. We went back to corrections if we needed more from them. We had to seek out all of the victims of the crimes in these cases. And that was a very difficult task. My office has no investigators. We are resource depleted, and years ago the investigators were taken out of the county budget, so we have nobody on staff who actually can go out and look for the victims of these crimes. So we were dependent upon the police agencies, and in most of the cases it was the City of Flint Police Department that had to do the legwork for us. And of course, as is pretty well known by now, the City of Flint has resource depletion issues. The police department, which once was 300 officers, is down to 100 officers. So there's a whole host of problems that existed in trying to get all the information we needed and to follow the Supreme Court dictate, to follow Michigan law, and to get this right. And we wanted to make sure that the victims were not just dealt out of this situation, because the prosecutors of this state, including myself, were very victim-oriented. Ever since the days of the Van Regenmorter Act, which made victim rights constitutional as well as statutory, prosecutors are very, very sensitive to the issues that victims face in the system. So we wanted to make sure they were part of this.
I definitely want to get to that further a little later, but I want to clear up a couple of things that you mentioned. So you had 26 cases that were affected by this 2016 Supreme Court ruling. You decided that in 23 cases, the life sentence should remain in place, but the Supreme Court has said that that should be exceedingly rare. That seems incongruent to me that you have 23 of 26 that should remain. Why did you think that many were necessary?
Well, on each one of them, we did a very specific review. You know, as I mentioned, the prosecutors came in with their review, presented the cases to our panel, and we looked at each one of them. For example, I'll just give you one example. There's a case of a fellow named Terry Morris. He shot six people to death back in 1987 in a house in Flint.
Right. I read about that case.
He was 17 years old at the time. He opened fire on a person who he felt had disrespected him and then shot the others just so there should be no witnesses. It was as heinous a crime as Flint has ever seen. So we got his records from the prison, and they weren't all that impressive. And we made the determination that rehabilitation was not going to be something that he would be successful at and that he needed to remain as a prisoner who faced life without the possibility of parole. That's just one case. There's a number of others, and I could go on and on, but we looked very carefully at each and every case and made the determination where we could that there were some, you're right, not a lot, but some who could be rehabilitated and who should not be facing life without parole.
So how do you determine when somebody is irredeemable?
Not an easy call, is it? We have to look at originally the crime. You can't factor out the victims. And with all due respect to the United States Supreme Court, I don't think that it really factored in victims' rights when it made its decision. And because Michigan law and Michigan's constitution requires us to factor that in, I think rightfully so. And I think correctly, all of the prosecutors who have these cases did so. It's, you know, there's no book you can pull off the shelf that will say, okay, Terry Morris should be given another chance, or Nathan Bell should be given another chance, or the young man who cut off his stepfather's head should be given another chance. These are difficult decisions that we had to make, and I think we did it properly in light of Miller and Montgomery.
You mentioned the families of the victims. How much input do they get in these cases? You seek them out? Do you have a sit down and talk with them? How does that go?
Yes, we have to identify them from the files, which sometimes we can't even find, and then we have to try to find them. Many of them have moved away from the Flint area. It's a very arduous process because it's hard to find them, identify them, get them in here, and then you have to walk them through something which was probably the most traumatic episode in their lives.
Are all of them saying, you've got to fight this, or are some of them saying, hey, look, it's been 40 years or whatever the time might be?
Interestingly, there have been some who said we didn't think that the individuals should have been prosecuted and received life without parole in the first place. And in one of those cases, I certainly agreed, and we have asked for a term of years for the individuals. So it's been a little bit, there's been a few instances where people have agreed that the defendants should get a term of years. And then there have been most instances where the victims said they should be locked up and they should never get out.
So what would it take for you to make a decision that might be contradictory to the victims' family's wishes?
I would have to be convinced that the crime in and of itself at the time it was perpetrated was something that was done by an individual who didn't really understand the consequences of his or her action, as well as a prison record that showed that the individual has made considerable progress while being incarcerated.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Candy. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton for our series, Michigan's Juvenile Lifers, Who Gets a Second Chance? I want to talk about this disagreement over whether these resentencings should be held before a judge or a jury. We spoke with Kalamazoo County Prosecutor Jeffrey Getting, and here's how he described the resentencing process.
Normally, when we think about the criminal justice system and the person who has the authority to make that decision regarding the consequence to be imposed, we're talking about the court. And we're talking about making a decision after being provided with all of the information from both sides, advocating, as I do, for the people of the state of Michigan and for the victims of the crime, and on the other side, advocating for the defendant, the person who was convicted of murder.
So you have to look at whether the juvenile might have been abused as a kid, whether there are other mitigating factors, evidence about behavior in prison. So it kind of sounds like he's calling for a finding of facts. Each side puts forth their witnesses. There's evidence admitted. Would you agree? Is that something a jury should hear instead of a judge?
I don't think it's a jury decision. I think historically Michigan sentencings have been handled by a judge. I think that's correct. I think that that's what, you know, the Supreme Court needs to decide in the cases of Hyatt and its progeny. But what I do think is correct is that ultimately the judge will make the decision. We are the kind of like the first line of defense, if you will. As ministers of justice, we decide whether to go forward with juvenile life without parole or with a term of years. Just because we recommend the juvenile life without parole doesn't mean the judge is going to make that determination. Ultimately, under Michigan sentencing law, the judge, hopefully not the jury, but the judge will make that call.
Why hopefully not the jury?
Because you're going to have to retry the case if it's the jury. I don't think we're in any position to do that. There's no way I can take a case that's 50 years old, find the witnesses that I would need to present to the jury precisely what happened in the underlying crime that led us to this point.
Yeah, but we're not talking about retrying the case. We're talking about a sentencing hearing that has new evidence being brought in.
I think you are, Lester. I think you have to retry the case if you're going to get a jury of lay people to understand why it is we're here today asking for juvenile life without parole. You can't do it just based upon new evidence. You have to be able to show everything that transpired, and it would require a retrial of that case.
We talked earlier about how much of a burden this has been on your office. There are something like 363 of these resentencings that take place across the state. Do you think that offices like yours should be getting some new resources from the state to handle this extra burden?
Absolutely, and I've been in front of the legislature asking for it. We had a meeting with the Senate Subcommittee on Judiciary Appropriations, and I may be getting the moniker wrong, but I think I'm close. And we asked for a significant stipend. Ultimately, I think all we got was $700,000, which is far insufficient. So, yes, we should get money.
What's your assessment as a prosecutor in terms of safety? I mean, how safe are people in Genesee County, and how safe will they continue to be depending on whether more of these juvenile lifers are released or not?
If an individual is released, I don't think these individuals would be any different than the many parolees who come back every week. I get a list of parolees being returned to the community every week. Sometimes we have to flop them back, and sometimes they succeed. I wish there was more programming to help these individuals while they were incarcerated and once they're put on parole. I think we need to do a better job with those types of programs. But overall, it's kind of a case-by-case basis.
David Layton is the prosecutor for Genesee County. Thanks very much for talking with us about this.
Lester, thank you so much for having me on.